This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. Who better to give book recommendations than librarians? In our last episode, we started our discussion of best books of 2012 and a little sneak peek of 2013. So we're just continuing that discussion here with another group of librarians.
My name is Stephanie Anderson. I'm the head of Readers Advisory at Darien Library in Connecticut, and you can find me online, mostly Twitter and Tumblr, as Bookivore. I have a very long list of favorite books of 2012. I think I managed to cut it down to about 24, but then I keep thinking of some and adding more on. So I just gave up on making sort of a final best of 2012 list. And there were so many of them online that I felt like it wasn't like I needed to put something out there that I think everyone's pretty well covered it. We had a lot of talks on our staff about what was our favorite book, which is something I always hate to pick, but I think it would have to be Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. I read the book earlier this year after hearing Nan Graham say it was the best book, one of the best books she'd ever worked on in her career. That made me very anxious to read it. And I loved his first book, The Noonday Demon, which is about depression and has held up really well. I would still recommend that wholeheartedly to anybody who's had any experience with depression. But Far From the Tree, I think the reason it sticks out for me on a list of very good books is just because I read it, I guess, mid-year as a galley, and it has come up in more conversations, and I've thought about it more than almost any other book I've read. Part of that is just it's a 1,000-page book that covers a lot of different parts of the human experience, and so in a way it's sort of cheating that I'm thinking about it and talking about it so much. But not only do I think about it all the time, but it's one of those books that I can truly say has changed the way I look at the world and myself, and being in a public library and interacting with so many different kinds of people, I think this book has made me a much kinder and more understanding person, especially from a public service standpoint where you don't usually know who you're dealing with, and you kind of have to be making some surface judgments. And I think the book has made me want to be a better person, which is, I guess, one of the best things you can get out of a book.
Yeah, exactly.
Should I say what it's about? I guess I'm sort of assuming people know what it's about because it got so much press. But
you can give a little synopsis.
In a nutshell, basically, Andrew Solomon, who has been working on this book since he finished The Noonday Demon, by the way. So this is like over 10 years of work. And he spent time with hundreds of families and literally logged thousands of hours with families. And what he was interested in is the idea that there's two kinds of identity, right? There's the identity you get from your parents. So that's like, that can be your gender, or not your gender, your ethnicity, your religion, things like identities that you have in common with your family and your parents in particular, because he became very interested in the relationships between children and parents. But what the book examines is the different kind of identity, which is one that it is very unlikely that it can be very unlikely that you share it with your parents. For example, being a transgendered person or being deaf and being a prodigy. In particular, he looks at musical prodigies, being schizophrenic, and he goes through 8 different things, and each chapter in and of itself is like a book. You could literally, I am not kidding you, read one chapter of the book, read nothing else, and you would still be a smarter, better person for having done it. And there's sort of a book ended by these longer introductions and conclusions where he talks about why personally he was interested in it and tells you a little bit about his personal life, which normally I can't stand, but he does that very well in The Noonday Demon, and he does it very well in this book as well. Because he's just a great writer. That's the other thing. The book itself would be interesting, even if like not the best writer did it, because of the research he did and the amount of time he's given to thinking about this stuff. But he is, I think, one of the best nonfiction writers writing in the English language right now. So it's just like it's a powerhouse combination. And it's huge. So I think a lot of people are scared off of it. It got like the New York Times Book Review cover and made all these best of lists. And I think what I see in the library is a lot of patrons see it and they're like, oh, God. and that's what we keep telling them. I managed to convince about half my staff to read it and they all loved it as well. It made our group top 10 list. for the year. And what we keep telling people is just read one chapter, just read two chapters, just look at the list, pick a couple and read them. And what we're working on our spring book discussion list right now, and we really want to this book to be in discussion. We're trying to pick the chapters because obviously we can't ask people to read the whole book and come talk about it. But right. I think what we're going to do is pick two and hope that people are so intrigued by the book that a lot of them will choose to read more of it. So that was a lot of time talking about one book. I'm sorry, but it's really good.
Well, it's a big, long book. So
it's exactly. You can't expect to talk about a 1,000-page book in like 1 minute. Trying to look at, I've printed out my list because I keep changing it on the computer. In terms of stuff that people are probably already have on their list, but maybe I can just second it. I thought The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich was great. Robert Caro's The Passage of Power. I think Robert Caro, if Andrew Solomon is one of the best nonfiction writers right now, Robert Caro is probably the best biographer. Mm-hmm. Gone Girl, I loved, who didn't bring up the bodies. The Middlesteins by Jamie Attenberg. Building Stories. May We Be Forgiven, A.M. Holmes's new book. Those are all, like, I guess, more popular things that I really liked. But there are also some weird ones on here, so I'd rather talk about them. Is that okay?
Yes, because other people will probably talk about things like Gone Girls.
Books that people maybe missed. Let's see, what's a good one? Okay, so here's one. The Legend of Pradeep Mathew by Shehan Karuna Talaka. This book came out in the spring from Grey Wolf. It was a paperback original, so I wonder if some libraries didn't skip it. And it's also like a very small press, and it won a number of prizes in Asia. And it's basically, and the problem is when you explain it out loud, it doesn't sound very interesting. But it's set in Sri Lanka, and the main character is an alcoholic, aging sports writer who loves cricket, and cricket is his whole life. And he gets obsessed. He's sort of getting to the end of his career, and he gets obsessed with this cricketer named Pradeep Mathew, who played for Sri Lanka very, very briefly. And if the stories about him playing are true, he was one of the best cricketers ever to play. And sort of the theory behind the book is like, what if the person who's most talented at something grows up in the wrong time and place for it? Like, how many of the most talented human beings in the world do we not know about because they grew up in a place that didn't have that sport or didn't have that, you know, musical instrument or something.
Right.
So he gets obsessed with tracking this guy down and proving he exists. That's like all he wants to do before he dies. And so that's what the book is about. And it's a long book. And what comes out in it is a lot of stuff about cricket and a lot of stuff about Sri Lanka, which are two things I knew very little about before I started the book. You really don't need to know anything about them because he has sort of mastered the art of telling you about it without being too expositionary. But it ends up being a much bigger story than that. It's incredibly touching. And there's a lot of stuff with his family. It's very funny. And really the best way I could explain it to you now is that we have a program here at the library called Meet Us on Main Street, where we take turns on Wednesdays book talking to whoever shows up. And I book talked this book, and like most of the people are just looking at me like, why are you trying to recommend to us this huge book on cricket and Sri Lanka? But one of our patrons, a regular patron, was like, I will take that home, and came back the next week and book talked it to everybody. And she even put a little post-it in it, and I kept the post-it and I hung it up on my bulletin board because I was so glad that like I had found one more person in the world who really liked it. And I'm trying to see if I can see from my desk what she wrote. She wrote things like, how much love do you need in a lifetime? Is sport really greater than life? Unlike life, sport matters, which is a quote from the book. That sticks out of my mind, not only because I really liked it and I wish more people would read it. Actually, I think it would be a great book group discussion book because there's so much about, I know a lot of book groups like to focus on literature from other countries, and Sri Lanka is one that most people probably haven't read about. But also it sticks out in my mind as a book that I like successfully paired with another human being. So I wish that could happen more.
Yeah, that's always fun when you put books on display and then you notice that it's gone later. It's like, yay, somebody got the book that I wanted.
I was like, phew, back out into the world. I would also recommend it. I found the more I talk about this book, I've met a lot of people who have cricket in their lives one way or the other. I was very surprised because you don't think about it, but between patrons who are from like India or British people or whatever, Australians, that it's astonishing how many people are obsessed with cricket. And I still don't really understand the game of cricket, although I tried really hard while I was reading this book to understand it. But I feel like I could at least enjoy it. Like, it is really fun to listen to other people. You know, people who liked Netherland by Joseph O'Neill, if they liked the cricket stuff, this is like the best, perhaps the only other cricket book I've ever read. But in terms of just like, you know, if you read that book, Joseph O'Neill clearly loves cricket, and so does Shehan Karuna Talaka. So it's sometimes it's just fun to read people writing about something they love that desperately, you know?
Yes.
What is another weirdo one? Oh, for a like more sort of lighthearted fiction read, I loved Angel Maker by Nick Harkaway. This is his second novel, and his first novel was The Gone Away World, which came out a couple years ago, and which is one of my favorite books of the last 10 years, like hands down, and is sort of attaining a little bit of a cult classic status, I think. And that one was much more of like a post-apocalyptic sci-fi book. This one's very much a spy novel, and I love spy novels. And it's sort of like a... it's like a more technological spy novel, and it's set in sort of like in London, is sort of a similar London, but there's a couple things that are different. It goes back and forth in time to like the Cold War era to now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it didn't do better. I thought people loved spy novels, but anyway, that is a really fun book. If you have the hardcover in your library, I would recommend it too, because the cover itself has a code, which I have not been able to crack, but there's a lot of stuff online about like the cover designer developed this entire code for the design of the book. So like if you read, you can figure out the code on the book. There's more, it's like an extra part of the story, basically.
That's cool.
Which is pretty fascinating. And I love when like they get to do stuff like that with the design. I don't think the paperback's coming out soon and it doesn't have the code. So you have to look at the hardcover and it's not like inside. It's like literally just the dust jacket. You don't have to take the cover off or anything. So,
oh, cool.
so that's another one. I have some, are you talking to anyone about like middle grade and YA books at all? Do you cover that stuff at all?
I am, but feel free to go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, I really loved Bitter Blue by Kristen Cachore. It's the third book in a trilogy that people have really loved. The first one was Graceling and the second one is Fire. And that is a fantasy series that is like, I think a very good adult crossover for adults who read fantasy. But I don't know, I don't think it's really been marketed that way. And so I always try to recommend that to grownups. The third one was just as good. I think they were all incredible. Like not a one of them has been bad yet, which is kind of rare for a trilogy. So I really liked that one. And I also really loved a book called Intentions by Deb Heiligman, which is a YA book. It's a contemporary YA about a girl who, and this is why it has some adult interest, in the first five pages of the book, goes to her synagogue and hears her rabbi having sex with someone who's not his wife on the bima, which is sort of like at the front of the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
In the book. And it like shatters her faith, and like her family is going through a bunch of stuff. And that's like how the book starts. Like you literally meet the character and that's the next thing that happens.
Oh, wow.
So I imagine it's not making it into every teen collection in America, but I think a lot of, I've actually found it to be very compelling just in terms of, as an adult getting to revisit that point in your teen life where you start to realize that grownups are just like you, but older, and that they don't have all the answers, and to sort of like get to think about that stuff again. It's very funny, very, a lot more complex than a lot of modern contemporary YA in the sense that there's not like grownups are bad and I'm smart and everybody's, you know, nobody listens to me. There's a lot more going on there, like really genuine human relationships. And I when I looked back, when I was trying to figure out what my favorite books were of the year, I kind of just looked at my bookshelves and tried to remember what year I'd read things. And I was surprised to have that one pop out at me immediately. I was like, oh yeah, I loved that book. I was like instantly pulled into it and, you know, reading it on the train and I couldn't stop reading it. So, I know adults either like read YA or don't read YA, but this would be, I think, a good one for anyone who's like curious about YA, wanted to read something more recent. I think that would be a good one. Intentions by Deborah Heiligman. I'm always surprised by like some of the stuff reading YA dredges up for me to be like, I had things I had like almost willfully forgotten popping back up. But that one in particular, I really liked. Oh, there's so many books on this list.
It's always hard to ask librarians to make a list like this because we read so much and like so much. And
what else kills me about these lists is that I don't know a single person, librarian or not, who just reads books published the year they're published. And so, like, half of the great books I read this year were published years ago. Like, I only read the Robert Caro book because I actually read all of them this year for the first time. Like, I'm a huge fan of presidential biographies, and I had been just putting off reading the Robert Caro ones for whatever reason. And finally, I couldn't do it anymore. So this summer, I just sat down and read all four of them in a row. And, like, all four of them combined are probably the greatest thing I read all year. Like, the combined force of, like, 2,500 pages on Robert Caro, or on LBJ, you know? But that doesn't count when you make these lists. And they'd all sort of blend together, I guess, a little bit, too. But I wish that more people made lists with, like, older books, because that's, I think, one of the great things about being in the library is that you have access to these books you've always meant to read, or, you know, that everyone's got a favorite book that no one else has ever heard of. And, you know, you finally get to read them, but just because they were published 30 years ago, they don't count for your list. Oh, I thought of another one. This one came out very early in 2012, so I worry it got forgotten. It's called By Blood by Ellen Ullman. Do you know this book? She has two other books. I've read the first one, which was a memoir called Close to the Machine. She was a programmer. I don't know if she still is. I guess she's not. But and it's very much about, like, what was it like being a programmer, and specifically what was like being a female programmer in, like, a very male world. So about that real life stuff. But she also writes a lot about what it's like to be a programmer and what it feels like to program. And it's really gracefully written. Like, she's a great writer, and it's such a different, you don't normally get to think about it, but it's got, like, these real elements of art to it that you wouldn't think about unless you did it all the time. That's a very short book. This one is a novel, and it's very weird. And it's about the main character is this, like, you know, from the second you start reading the book that he's just a weirdo, and it's set in, San Francisco. See, it's been like a year since I read it. Like, San Francisco in the 70s. That would have been the time of the Zodiac Killer, right? So he's like, all you know about him is that he's a professor and that he's sort of in disgrace from wherever he used to be, and he's just strange. So he takes an office in an office building and to try and get some work done. And his office is right next to the office of a therapist who normally plays a white noise machine, but she has one client who can't stand the machine, so she has to turn it off. And since it's this old San Francisco office building, he can hear every word. And he starts to become obsessed with the story of the client, who is a lesbian, who's having trouble with her girlfriend, and she's adopted, and she has all these problems with her family. And for some reason, he gets, like, really fascinated and, like, has to listen, and he sits completely still so they'll forget there's somebody else there. But then he starts to insert himself into her life, and not in the way you would expect. Like, he doesn't, like, start stalking her or anything like that. He actually tries to help her find her family. Like I said, he's very strange. He has these strange ideas about family and being an individual and so on. And the book, what's interesting about it is that the vast majority of the interesting material and the writing is him eavesdropping through an office wall. You don't know basically what anybody looks like. He's just, like, imagining what they look like based on their voices. He doesn't know the therapist. He goes out of his way to avoid the therapist so she doesn't remember that there's somebody in the office next door and he can keep listening. And you get little parts of his backstory. His life starts to intrude more and more as the book goes on. But it's just such a daring way to tell a story, and it works really, really well. Not only is it sort of a creepy story, but then on top of that, the setting is very eerie. It's like San Francisco, which is very seedy, and you have the Zodiac Killer running around, and the weather's not great. It's just a strange, strange book, and it illuminates. There's actually a lot of things about earlier decades, because she starts to find out where her family is from. But in a lot of ways, I felt like it was a very American book. Like, it was highlighting a lot of the things about America people don't like to read books about. Mm-hmm. But I just loved it. It really haunted me for weeks. And I went to go see her read from it. She's this very small woman and very unassuming and very, like, plainly dressed. And for some reason, that just freaked me out even more. Like, I was imagining someone, like, really wild and crazy would come up with this creepy story. And the thing that this really creepy story had come out of this very normal-looking woman, like, made me even more freaked out. But yeah, that's, what is it? By Blood by Ellen Ullman. And, like, the idea of blood and blood ties and so on are very important through the book. That and Pradeep Mathew. There's a couple others on this list, I guess, that I just feel like if I could, like, were my, like, most under... Wait, are they underlooked or overlooked? Overlooked. Overlooked of 2012. There's a, like, for short stories, I loved a book called I Am an Executioner by Rajesh Paramaswaran. I think was a great short story collection, but it was, like, short stories and came out in February. So I guess those are books that tend not to make any lists. I liked Zona by Jeff Dyer. I love everything Jeff Dyer does. I think he's a genius. And Zona is particularly ballsy because... it's like a book about a movie I hadn't even seen. And it's like not even particularly a good movie. And the whole book is about the movie. That's it. And Jeff Dyer does this sort of thing all the time, I guess. But it's fascinating. I still haven't seen the movie. I have no interest in seeing the movie, even after reading like a whole book about it. but that is another one I was surprised I didn't like see on very many lists. It's not like a masterpiece or anything, but it was really, really funny. And like, you, I like books where you start to get the sense that the author is messing with you. You know? Like the author is maybe not taking this as seriously as you are. I think it's good to be surprised as a reader that way. Because like, you go into books with like a certain expectation of what they're for. Like Martin Amis's book, which I really liked, the Lionel Asbo, did the same thing. Like there were definitely times, there's actually a time in the book where the main character, Lionel Asbo, says to his nephew, I think this book is taking the piss. And you're like, oh my God, so is Martin Amis. Martin Amis is like actively telling you that he is messing with you in this book right now. I don't know. I like that in a book. J. Robert Lennon's new book kind of does that a little bit too, Familiar, which I really liked. And now I'm looking at this list, I'm seeing lots of books that are like actively messing with you. The Lifespan of a Fact by John DeGatta and Jim Fingal, which came out earlier this year. It's the one John DeGatta, who wrote About a Mountain. He wrote this essay that About a Mountain turned into. And do you know this story? He wrote it for Harper's. Yes, Harper's. And Harper's fact-checked it and refused to publish it. And so then they were like, no, you can't fact check enough of this. We can't publish it. And he was like, I'm not changing it. So then he took it to The Believer and they published it, but their fact checker, who was just like some intern, like a 21-year-old kid whose name is Jim Fingal. Now he's not 21. Now he's grown up, got in this sort of dialogue with him about a lot of the things, because John DeGatta has always vocally been one of these people who's like, I'm an essayist. I'm not writing 100% fact. Like this is an essay and I'm going to move little details around and make composite characters. And you know, this sort of bigger argument about what is nonfiction. The book itself is like the entire essay printed in little squares in the middle of each page. And then the text around it, it's really beautifully laid out, is them arguing, presumably over email. Although what you learn later is that this is not, it's not like they actually emailed back and forth about this for months. A lot of this is reconstructed, which is in itself very interesting, like on a meta level, that like even the fact checking is not completely factual. Like the process of the fact checking did not actually happen that way, but they end up getting into this really big argument and like they're kind of mean to each other. Huge, huge argument about like, what is nonfiction? What is an essay? What is the author's obligation when they tell their reader that something is true, you know, like is the spirit of the thing more important? And if he actually waited 7 seconds instead of 8 seconds and seven sounds better in the sentence or eight sounds better in the sentence, like what is your obligation as a writer to say the right number or to say the thing that sounds better? Mm. And they've deliberately staked out their claims in a very extreme manner to sort of tease out all the parts of the argument. But I think especially as you have more and more like memoirs in particular, that are like coming out to be aggressively non-true. What I thought was interesting about this book too was seeing a lot of writers who I really admire react to it. And most of them take John DeGatta's side, which is like, well, sometimes you got to fudge things a little bit to make it better art, which I found really disillusioning. I was like, oh no, every nonfiction writer you read is fudging things a little bit. But then I was like, why do I care so much? I had a lot of interesting, I led a book group on the book actually, which is probably why it stuck with me, because people tend to react to it one or the other ways. And it turns out John and Jim are actually friends. You would never guess it from the book because they're like cursing at each other in the book, which is even more interesting. So that's another really a good one. And it's short. It's got like this very weird trim size. It's like a square. And that would be another great one for book groups. I think especially book groups that are that read nonfiction. I know not all book groups do, but it's like almost, it would almost be a great way to like retake stock, like as a nonfiction book group, to sort of read this larger conversation about like what kind of books you're reading and what are the authors thinking when they work on it. Because I was really stunned by the number of like very big name A-list nonfiction writers who were like, well, of course Sean DeGott is right. Like, you can't have everything be factually true 100% of the time, which I don't know. My assumption as a reader has always been, unless I'm told otherwise, everything is factually true 100% of the time, which I guess is very naive. So
right, that's what I thought too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and I think a lot of it is that, you know, the writers themselves, what comes out in the book and a lot of the reviews I read of it, is they just see themselves as using the words very differently. Like, to them, essay does not mean 100% factually true. Like, an essay, you know, goes back to Montaigne and Voltaire, and like that there's, it's like sort of this combination art, and that the problem is really ours, like as librarians or as bookstores and publishers who need to label something as either fiction or nonfiction for like marketing purposes, basically, or for cataloging purposes. Mm-hmm. And that's not, and John DeGott is, feeling is like, that's not my problem. You can market it and catalog it however you want. Yeah. But it's not fiction either, you know? The two of them in conversation with Heidi Julewicz, who's the editor of The Believer and who writes novels, some wise ass because some people came to that very aggressively. Like, most people had read it already and really hated John DeGott as a result. And were asking him these really intense questions, and it was basically like, well, if you want a license to make things up, why don't you just write fiction, like factually based fiction? And he turned to Heidi and was like, well, I don't know, Heidi, you write fiction. I don't. Do you feel like the only thing that makes your work fiction is the fact that it's not true? And she was like, well, no, I guess there's a lot more going on than that. Like, I don't, you're building things, you know, when you write fiction, it's not just like, oh, well, this isn't true. And in fact, some of it probably is true. It was just one of those, you know, the conversation around the book is just as interesting as the book. And I think for a lot of readers who are like, you know, really intense readers, it's interesting to think about that stuff every once in a while.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
And yeah. And it's short, too. You could read it in like one sitting.
Yeah. That's always helpful sometimes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I know. Sometimes that's a real selling point for a book.
And you've got some books that are coming out in 2013 that you're looking forward to?
Do. I know I told you before that I didn't, but then when I thought about it, I realized it. Well, I'll tell you what's going around the library like wildfire right now is Kate Atkinson's new book, which I believe comes out in March or April. It's called Life After Life, three words. And it's not at all like her more recent mysteries, like Case Histories and Started Early, Took My Dog. It goes all the way back to being very similar to her first book, which I believe is called Last Night at the Museum. Behind the Scenes at the Museum. So this was her first book that came out in like the mid-90s and won a lot of awards. And it's like much more sort of like a contemporary England, but also looking at basically the whole 20th century. It's one of those books that's kind of hard to describe because you don't want to give anything away. But I guess it's not giving anything away to say that the main character at the beginning of the book is born and then dies immediately and then is born again. And then lives for a while and then dies. And it becomes clear over the course of the book that she's kind of meant to do something. So it's kind of like almost like Groundhog Day, but not funny, where she keeps changing things slightly, but she doesn't even know why she's doing it. So the older she gets, the more she becomes aware that she's like, this is not her first time on this particular merry-go-round, but she doesn't quite know why. And she just has a sense that she should do something or a sense that she should not do something. It is just, Kate Atkinson is such a good writer, just like mind-blowingly good. And did you read 11/22/63, Stephen King's book?
No, I haven't read that one yet.
It's very similar to that in almost no ways, but the one way in which it's similar is that, well, A, there's like an element of movement and time. It's like many books in one book. Like, there are a couple sections of both the Stephen King book and this one where like you read about 100, 150 pages and you realize, and in anybody else's hands, that would have been a book. Like, you would have been done. They would have handed it in. That would have been it. Like, there's a whole section that's based around the Blitz in London that by itself would be perfect. But then it's set in this much larger story. I just loved it. And it's been, you know, it's a good book when like everyone keeps actually bringing their galley back into the library and handing it to somebody else. Cause everyone is just so anxious that we should all read it. So that is probably the library's number one book. I'm really excited about a book, a first novel called The Lullaby of Polish Girls by Dagmara. I'm going to mess up her last name. It's Polish. Domniczek. But the Lullaby of Polish Girls, that's easier to remember, which is set in America and in Poland in like the 70s, 80s, and modern day. And it's about three girls who are best friends and just them sort of growing up in Poland, which is obviously changing very rapidly at the time, and going back and forth between Poland and the U.S., which couldn't have been more different at the time. Just a very different take on sort of that, like, coming-of-age immigrant story, and really great writing. I liked that a lot. Joe Hill has a new book, Stephen King's son.
I've heard that. I've never gotten into him yet, but I keep thinking I need to start reading him.
Yeah, you know what? I really like him, and I was really, when Heart-Shaped Box first came out, like, forever ago, I was like, ugh. Who goes into, not only do you go into writing, but you write exactly the same thing as your parent. Like, how crazy? Why would you do that to yourself? But he's just, I mean, he's equally a great writer. And in fact, it's interesting. They have a lot of interesting similarities as writers. Like, they're very different. But, I feel like someone should write a term paper on it or something. But his new one I really liked. His books are creepy in a very different way from Stephen King's books, but still, like, each of his books I've read managed to have some visual image that, like, really, really haunts me, like, sticks with me and, like, shows up in my dreams. Like, he's just got real, I know that doesn't work for, not everybody actually wants that, but I really like, it's called Nosferatu, but it's spelled really weird to look like a license plate. It's like, I don't even know. It's like NOS4. It's going to be a nightmare for catalogers.
Yes.
But that's really good.
With him, I like the fact that he used a pseudonym so he could make it on his own and without using,
yes,
not jumping on his dad's name. Like, certainly.
Don't you really admire that about him? I find that really admirable. Although, if you see a picture of him, you can see why he had to give up the game, because, like, you'd never be like, oh, have you ever met a guy named Stephen King?
Yeah, I think it's like a time travel thing where he actually is just the younger version of Stephen King.
So. It wouldn't surprise me. I wonder if, like, one day they'll collaborate on a book along that theme, because it would be in, like, both of their wheelhouses to do something.
Yep.
So that is really good. I feel like there's – all of a sudden I realize there actually are a lot of books I'm excited about. The only thing I can think of that's been really popular at the library in the last couple of weeks is that 8-Hour Diet book.
The diet books are going to come out this week because everyone needs to lose their holiday weight.
Yes. So. Yeah. The 8-Hour Diet is a particularly flummoxing one. Right now I'm reading, a late 2012 entry. They did a reader's edition of The Red Book by Carl Jung, that crazy big one.
Mm-hmm.
They have like a small edition that's just the words, no pictures. And it's really fascinating, but I don't think I understand it at all. But I think it'll probably be like a favorite if I can understand it. But he basically wrote down, he like taught himself how to do like active imagination stuff and wrote down all of his fantasies and then analyzed them and essentially drove himself crazy and then talked himself back out of it. And it was only just published, you know, as that huge book recently. And now everyone thinks it's like the most important book he ever did. I don't know if he held on to it for so long. I think maybe it makes more sense with the pictures. I don't know if reading it for the first time without the pictures is the smartest thing I ever did in my life. But, that's a pretty cool one. I feel like I'm always so jealous of people. Do you know people, or maybe you are one of these people who like actually writes down everything you read?
Oh, no, I don't do that.
I always feel like I should, and I've just never, I guess, come up with a way of doing it. I've tried it a couple times, but it must make this kind of conversation so much easier.
Yeah, well, and I appreciate the library ethical thing of, you know, erasing records when you turn things back in. It's like, I really would like to have a record of everything that I checked out from the library.
Yeah. I feel like that's something that patrons actually say to us a lot. They're like, I don't care about my privacy. I just want to know what book I checked out last year.
Yeah, we've actually talked about that in a future ILS, of having that as an opt-in kind of thing where you can, if you want to have that, you can do that. So maybe
we do have it as an opt-in. We have Polaris. I didn't even turn it on until a couple months ago because I didn't even know about it. Now that I know about it, I try to tell people, but it's kind of a weird thing to bring up in conversation. Be like, oh, by the way, would you like to keep track of what you're reading?
Yeah.
That's kind of strange. But then it's only the stuff I checked out from the library, too.
Right. That's still not everything yet, because I still...
I would love to hear, like, if other librarians do that. There must be people who are... And then what if you could, like, label them as you went back? Like, if you were smart enough to do that, like, an Excel document or something, and then...
I'm sure there are people who do that.
There must be people. Oh, yeah. Everything I'm seeing here is, like, all stuff that's old. I didn't check out very many new books from the library. Mostly checked out old books.
Well, I think that was a really good list that you gave me.
Oh.
So.
I was like, I don't know how many more books you want.
No, that's fine. No, that's fine.
I mean, I could keep doing this all day. Want me to tell you very quickly what our top 10 of the staff was?
Okay.
Because I think it's a really interesting list, and it makes me very proud of my staff. So I basically had them all, well, they were only supposed to send me 10 books each, but then all of them sent me, they were like, well, I couldn't narrow it down to 10, so I did like 12 or 15. No surprise there. But then I only did 10. So in alphabetical order, our top 10 are The Art of Hearing Heartbeats by Jean-Philippe Sendker, which is one of the only ones on this list I haven't read, but everybody else in my staff loves it. And a lot of our book groups have read it. Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel. Burn Down the Ground by Cambry Cruz, which is a memoir. Elsewhere, Richard Russo's memoir. Oh, yeah, I think I would have probably added that to my list if I had been thinking. That was really good. The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwalbe. Far from the Tree by Andrew Solomon. Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore by Robin Sloan. Quiet by Susan Cain. Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rifka Brunt. That's also been a huge book group favorite for us. And The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce, which has also been a huge book group book for us. So I like that list. That's a nice eclectic list. And I didn't have to massage it at all to make it come out that way. That's actually the way the numbers came, which is really nice. You know, sometimes to have an interesting list, you have to play with it a little bit, but I didn't have to touch it.
You didn't have to throw out any James Patterson books or something?
No.
That spoiled your list. You always hate seeing this long great list, and then like in the middle of it, number 7, Merry Christmas, Alex Cross. It's like, wait.
Yeah. I mean, luckily that's our favorites and not our Cirque. I keep meaning to look up, like, I assume our most Cirque book of last year is Gone Girl. That's got to be it. Just based on the holds list.
Yeah, that's what I would guess. Yeah, that's what I would guess, too. Of course, we have more copies of the Patterson books, probably, though, so they might. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know what happened, though? I think there were so many of them coming out in December, those Patterson books. Like, I feel like there was a new one every week. So
yeah.
I feel collectively, we actually probably have more Gone Girl, because, like, we couldn't buy tons of each James Patterson.
Oh, right, yeah.
There were just too many of them. Like,
he's gotten to the point now where he's kind of his own genre.
Well, and it's hard to tell. Like, I was trying to learn about this the other day, because I had an older patron who only likes some of his series. And I know what some of them are, like the older ones, but especially with all of his like collaborative ones, I don't really know anything about those series at all.
Right. And then there's the YA ones and the middle grade ones.
It's just crazy. And I was like looking at his Wikipedia page to try and tell them all apart. It's very complicated. I saw the other day in Shelf Awareness that someone had been promoted to something like, the title was like VP of Publicity, James Patterson.
Well, you have to be, so I think.
An entire department at Little Brown or Grand Central that only does James Patterson, which there would have to be. I mean, otherwise, you couldn't just have one person working with it.
Yeah, he's a rich, rich man.
He is, yeah. He's laughing all the way to the bank.
All right, well, Stephanie, thank you so much for talking to me and giving me your lists.
Oh, thank you. It was a fun.
And how can people find you online?
People can find me on Twitter. My handle is Book of War, and I mostly blog at bookofwar.tumblr.com. And I guess that's it. And then we also, on our website, on the Darien, it's darienlibrary.org, regularly post, our collection development coordinator posts what everybody's reading on a weekly basis. So you can find a lot of good reading recommendations there as well. So darienlibrary.org.
All right.
As well.
Very
yep.
Cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Thomas Malik. I work with Richland Library in Columbia, South Carolina. You can find them on the web at richlandlibrary.com. I'm a youth services librarian. That means that I read tons of material for teens, tweens, and little ones. And that also means I like to specialize in comic books. It tends to be a huge conversation starter.
Yeah.
And Steve invited me on to talk about some of the best graphic novels of 2012, and I'd like to talk about some of them right here.
All right, well, welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I'd like to start off with the God of Comics, also called the God of Manga, Osamu Tezuka. Vertical Inc. Recently republished in two large hardcover volumes, Message to Adolf, which was a series that Tezuka did near the end of his career in the mid-80s. It had been published in English before in a set of hardcover and paperback volumes back in the 90s. But Vertical has the rights now. They did a new translation. It's in these two really thick hardcovers. I think it's an excellent starting point for people who don't know who this Tezuka fella is and who need a straightforward, exciting, more adult-themed thriller to jump in with. Tezuka tends to insert a lot of visual gags, a lot of inside jokes. He likes to reprise a lot of different characters' roles throughout all the different series of his career. And so Message to Adolf does very little of that. A lot of it is played very straight, a World War II thriller about espionage surrounding Adolf Hitler's true heritage, as well as these two boys, also named Adolf, one of whom reluctantly becomes a Hitler youth, even though he doesn't want to enter that lifestyle at all. And the other, who is also persecuted for the way he was brought up, you have this mixture of sort of German heritage and Japanese upbringing, and what those sort of loyalties will do to people, both as their children trying to resist it and when they grow up and it becomes more of a cultural acceptance. And there are a lot of really dark moments in this series that I think really show off Tezuka's ability to show just the darkness that humanity is capable of, but also sort of not the pure intentions, but just how humans can try to do one thing and then go completely wrong and then not realize it until much later in life.
Yeah, it sounds really good. I've never read anything by him before. So,
yeah, Tezuka, he invented numerous genres back in like the 40s and 50s. He worked in, I want to say it was an asbestos factory or a match factory. I think it was an asbestos factory. And his town, it got firebombed, and he watched just the horrors of World War II, just watching thousands of corpses get piled up and burned and that sort of thing. So this story is incredibly personal to him, and it's one that, if you know his biography, you know that he's been waiting to tell a story of this magnitude for a long time. Not that he's any stranger to epics and delving into characters' life stories, but here the effect is just overwhelming. Next, I want to switch over to the superhero track. I've been reading a lot of the New 52 as it comes out. I've been reading, lots of the Marvel franchises, a lot of Vertigo and Dark Horse and IDW. And a lot of it has been hit or miss. I think superheroes as a genre, you get that 10% of gold and then 90% of crap, which is a tough.
And do you generally read those as the monthlies, or do you wait for trades for those?
I wait for the trades on those. And it's one of those things where you might start into a superhero's legacy, and at the time you think, oh, this will be so much fun. And it's not until you read the right author and the right illustrator that you say, oh, this is how it should have been. This is so much better. And the past year's run on Daredevil, which is out in three collected trades by Mark Waid. And I'm going to roll off the list of the revolving door of artists on this. Paolo Rivera, Marcos Martin, Chris Samney, Mike Allred, Koi Pham, Kano, and Marco Cicchetto. They have done such a great job of giving us... Daredevil used to be this... And he still is sort of... He had a lot of angst in his life. Dear ones to him getting murdered or being corrupted or himself being corrupted. Just very dark, almost to an exhausting extent. And then Mark Waid comes along and this team and this army of artists, and they're able to bring the color back, the life back. Mark Waid was determined to pull Daredevil back into a more, it's more fresh, fun kind of storytelling where, okay, so he's blind and he was corrupt once and he's got a dead girlfriend and all this. But it's like, let's tell the story of this guy who has superpowers. He's fighting supervillains, and he sort of has fun with his identity. There's a rumor around town that Matt Murdock is Daredevil, and of course he is Daredevil. But he tries to deflect the rumors by sort of taking it on and then making fun of it to deflect any suspicion. So he'll show up to a Christmas party in a red sweater that says, "I'm not Daredevil." And he'll have a walking stick that looks like a candy cane.
Yeah, it seems like with Daredevil for the longest time, he was created in the 60s, and then it seems like nobody knew what to do with him for a really long time, and then Frank Miller did his run on it, and then everybody just tried to rip off Frank Miller for the next 20 years.
Yeah, and just making this ultra-serious, fighting crime and being the saving grace of Hell's Kitchen and all that. But there's so much visual potential, ironically enough, with a blind superhero. You get these gorgeous spreads where Daredevil will be walking with someone who can see and hear just fine. And throughout the scene, almost where each text bubble stops in the 2-page spread, you'll see, here's what Daredevil's friend is able to see and observe. And then there'll be this distortion, this small distortion on the page that lets you know, it'll show you either through negative color schemes or magnifying something that Matt Murdock, he's experiencing the world with very heightened senses. And they show that, if some pigeons scatter, if a dump truck drops something, that catches his attention much more sharply than just the people walking around him. Like, there's no ambient noise for him. Like, it's everything gets picked up.
Right.
And it's a really fun effect. And just, there's just sharp colors throughout the series, very clean line work, just very easy to read action. Like, the whole set is just, it's just a joy to read. There are no girlfriends in refrigerators, none of that.
Yeah.
There's no brooding on a rooftop in a thunderstorm going, I'll avenge you, Grandpa, or none of that. I guess it sort of goes in cycles. He's had his dark period. Now he gets to have more of a light period, and I'm really grateful for that. Next up, I want to talk about some adaptations that have been astounding. Various authors and artists have come together for the Graphic Canon, which is a planned 3-volume series. Volumes 1 and 2 came out so far in 2012. We could do a whole separate podcast about it, because the goal is to go after all of the literary canon, just try to grab as much as these artists and authors can get from different countries, different time periods, just go from the birth of literature to right up to David Foster Wallace, and just graph. Sometimes it will be, here's a collage inspired by this work of literature. And then sometimes it will be, here's a section of the text from this story with some pictures to go along with it. And then other times it'll be, here's a graphic novelization of it. And it's just, it's a huge literary sampler. Each volume clears 500 pages. One of the projects in the book comes from a librarian, Matt Kish, who is a librarian. He had a project where he was going to do Moby Dick in pictures, one drawing for every page, which is now a 552-page book. He finished it. Completely different styles of illustration from page to page, whether it's in color, black and white, whether he's showing off the iconography of certain sequences in the books, or he's just showing off Herman Melville's world in a certain way, or showing how the characters imagine the whale is going to be, or the way Ahab and the ship are going to be. You could criticize the book as, you're not getting the full literature with these. You're just getting these little bites and pieces. But those are bites and pieces. I want to read more of the classics now because of this. It'll let people get that visual sensation and say, I'll understand this better once I've read the actual books. And I think that's a great incentive.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I read a lot of those classics illustrated and stuff, and that helped me get interested in that kind of stuff too. So I'm glad they're still doing it in these days and a little bit more elaborately too.
I want to throw in as a bit of trivia, Tezuka, early in his career, he thought comics could be the bridge to bring children to adult literature, and he would adapt things like Faust and Crime and Punishment, but he would do it in his Disney-esque style that had all the little gags and small, more innocent illustrations. but it would be Crime and Punishment. And so people look at it and they say, well, you know, Tezuka kiddified Crime and Punishment. It's like, no, he brought it to the kids, and then those kids grew up, and now they all know Dostoevsky as a result. It's beautiful. Another adaptation I want to throw in is, and I just read this recently, Hope Larson's adaptation of Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. This is another example of an adaptation that makes you want to read the original. Apparently something went wrong with my upbringing, and I haven't read A Wrinkle in Time before. But based on the graphic novel, I clearly missed out on a very wonderful thing. Hope Larson, most of the book is rendered in blue and black, which it's a very stylized effect, which like a lot of stylized full graphic novel stylizations, I thought it would turn me off after the first few pages, but after the first few pages, it just becomes so natural. You just fall right into the world. And each of the children, Meg, Cal, and Charles Wallace, you just, through their facial expressions and the ways that their faces are represented when they go through their different emotions, there's just such a subtle touch letting you know what each of these children are thinking, even when they're not saying it. And there are certain sci-fi effects that I'm sure Madeline described beautifully on the page, but Hope Larson is also able to capture them in her drawings, where the children are doing interdimensional travel. They're supposedly going across the fifth dimension. And they go through a two-dimensional planet for a quick stop. And everyone's represented. All the characters traveling this method are represented as these flat lines in a panel. And then two of the characters start talking, and they're represented as vibrating lines because everybody's two-dimensional here. And then they come out the other side, and they're all regularly drawn characters again. And the people who are responsible for the transportation are going, you know, the kids can't handle that world. Now maybe people will continue to read the original book, and they'll say, oh yeah, I'm supposed to read this comic that's supposed to be so great. Maybe it'll go in reverse. The last title I want to talk about, one of my all-time favorites this year, it was such a joy, Raina Telgemeier's Drama, which Raina Telgemeier, she's regularly been doing the Babysitter's Club series of graphic novels, and those have been good in their own right. But when she focuses on a set arc, a single story, a single long-form story, she just knocks it out of the park. Smile came before this, and that was amazing. Speaking as someone who grew up with braces. But in Drama, I would say that this graphic novel, it's targeted at, I would say, that sort of middle school, late elementary through middle school age. It's so earnest. I'm sure there are some high schoolers who would probably pass it up and go, you know, this book isn't being cool enough, possibly. But it's a book that you can look back on, and you'll recognize all sorts of archetypes from going through public school. And you almost wish you could just adopt this Cali girl. Not because she goes through a horrible situation, but just because she's just the most sweethearted kid. It's really great to just follow her around. You have this middle schooler named Cali. She's in the drama club. They're putting on this large stage production, and she's in charge of special effects. And a lot of what happens in the book is it's so straightforward. They're all just sort of living their lives, and just, you know, they're having their crushes, and they're having these small dramatic entanglements, or trying to figure out, you know, why doesn't this boy like me, or how are we going to get the actress to, you know, quit stopping the show every so often, or how am I going to build a canon for this one special effect that it needs to wow everybody. You get these small character moments too that just, they're just so positive, but they don't toot their own horn either. When everybody's doing tryouts for the lead roles for singing, Kelly and her friends, they're sort of watching, they're giggling at some, and, you know, they're hoping that other people get the role and say, oh, he'd be really great, she'd be really great. And at one point, Kelly says, you know what, I'm going to go up and I'm going to sing. I'm going to try. And everyone's like, but, you know, you can't, do you really want the lead role, Kelly? She's like, well, you know, I might not be able to sing, but, you know, I can at least try. And she goes up and she does a terrible job. And a few people laugh or whatever. But then she goes back to her seat with her friends and they have a laugh about it. You know, she put herself out there. She had fun. And that's what mattered to her. It's not about the image or, you know, this is the moment that determines my life or anything like that. Like, it's the whole year that counts. And I think it's a view of, it's a view of childhood that it doesn't use rose-colored glasses, but it doesn't try to draw things in black and white, heroes and villains either. It's just Reyna builds up this world of humans just going through their human issues and human events, and just, like, it's such a gentle story, but it's also such a subtle and sensitive story. You can read things, just like in Hope Larson's adaptation of Wrinkle in Time. You can read things on the characters' faces that they might not be saying yet. And that's just one of the things I love about graphic novels. And those were some of the, I mean, I have a short list of great graphic novels of 2012 this far. We could probably do this for hours, but the ones that I've named so far, with Drama by Raina Telgemeier, Daredevil by Mark Waid and many artists, Message to Adolf by Osamu Tezuka, A Wrinkle in Time by Hope Larson, and the Graphic Canon series by another army of artists and authors. They have all been excellent titles this year, this past year, and I look forward to many more.
And is there anything that's coming out in this upcoming year that you're looking forward to particularly?
Oh, there's an older manga, a science fiction, short science fiction manga by Makoto Yukimura called Planetes. And this was one of those moments. I think anyone who reads a ton goes through this. Planetes ended, a few years go by, and I kept thinking, how come I don't hear about anything else from this guy? I love this series. I'd love to read whatever he does next. And sort of on the fringe of licensing agreements with like Vertical and Viz and other companies, fans keep asking for this series called Vinland Saga. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, I don't know what Vinland Saga is. And then I find out just recently that Vinland Saga 1, it's just recently gotten licensed. It's several volumes through in Japan. But that Makoto Yukimura is doing Vinland Saga, that he totally followed up on Planetes, and he has a new series, and everybody loves it, and it's in enormous demand to come to the States, and I'm just completely hyped to read it. And I can't wait for that.
He's back.
He's back. I know. And he was always back. I was just blind. Not the cool blind like Daredevil either.
Right. No radar sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me, Tom. And thanks for all the recommendations of the graphic novels.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Steve. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
My name is Julie Juergens, and I am the school services coordinator at the Arlington Heights Memorial Library in suburban Chicago. You can find me online at HiMissJulie.com, and my hip Twitter handle is the same, HiMissJulie. Some people misread it as Him is Julie, which is not grammatical or sensical, but if you want to think of it that way, I have no problem.
Thank you for being on the show, Julie.
You're very welcome. Thanks for asking me. Well, this was hard, picking my favorite books of 2012. But I do have some good ones and a couple that I'm looking forward to in 2013. I'll just kind of go all over the place. I think the one that affected me most this year was Lions of Little Rock by Kristen Levine. It's a really great story of, it's not the typical kind of, integration story. It happens a little bit after the, I've forgotten all my history after the, it's about a girl that, is passing as white. And, she makes friends with this girl who doesn't really make friends very easily. And she really connects. And, it just, I don't cry at books because I need that extra manipulation of, you know, the actors' faces and the musical. But this book actually like made me tear up a couple of times, and let me see if I can grab my my notes. I'm terrible with character names. I have no idea what any of them are named. But it's really good. I really liked it. Another one that I liked is 4 Mile by Watt Key. He wrote Alabama Moon. He's really kind of a great author who's writing contemporary fiction for like that kind of fourth to sixth grade audience, which I haven't been seeing a lot of. About this like 12-year-old boy who is his father has died, and we don't really find out what happened to his dad till quite far in the story. And his mother is trying to start a new relationship with this guy who's a complete jerk. It reminded me a lot of Shane, that old Western that mm-hmm. has a kid as the main character, but it's not really a kid's book. 4 Mile is definitely kind of the contemporary Shane that actually is for kids. And this mysterious man shows up who is an Iraq war veteran, and he is obviously suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And when I book talked this for some sixth grade classes, this is the one I talked about the most. And the kids were really kind of fascinated with the idea of someone having this, post-traumatic stress, because they know people who have been, you know, veterans of wars, and it's something that's really real for them. So I think that kind of sparked their interest. It's kind of a slow build, but the last part of the book is just a really kind of brutal fight between the bad boyfriend and the mysterious stranger and the young boy. And they eventually part ways. This is kind of a spoiler, but it's also a warning. There is a dog in the book, and it does not meet a happy end. So if you're that kind of person who doesn't like to read about the dog, you might want to skip over that part of the book. But it's really, really well done, and I really enjoyed that one. Another one kind of for fourth to sixth grade is The Cavendish Home for Boys and Girls by Claire LeGrand. This one was really a big hit when I did book talks this fall. It's about, it's kind of a weird, what would I call it? Kind of an alternate reality. This girl is very perfect. She wants her life to be perfect, and she starts being friends with this boy who's not perfect at all. He doesn't tuck in his shirt. He slouches. He never pays attention in school because he's always playing music. And she says, I'm going to fix him. I'm going to fix him up, and he will be my project. But then she starts to notice that people have been going missing, like certain students who are not perfect, who are quirky or a little strange. They disappear, and even their siblings don't know where they went. They just kind of say something vague about, oh, they're off visiting Aunt Lula in Wisconsin. And she realizes one day her friend is missing, and his parents just say the same thing, like, oh, he's off visiting relatives. And eventually she realizes that all these kids are ending up at the Cavendish Home for Boys and Girls. And the home itself is actually made up of people who didn't fit into the town and have physically become a part of the building. And it's really got that kind of slow, creepy vibe. It reminded me a lot of like Pan's Labyrinth, that kind of realism. And it's just kind of a spooky read that is good for that kind of fourth to sixth grade audience. Like it's scary, but not too scary. Another one that is a little bit more scary is Long Lincoln by Lindsay Barklow, based on an old English ballad that is super creepy. It's set in the 50s. It's set in Britain. So it kind of hits like these weird little pockets that readers, we might not think like kid readers being, but I'm sure there's some Anglophiles out there who like really kind of slow burn scary stories. It reminded me of maybe like The Orphanage, like that kind of spooky horror. It's not gory, it's not Saw, but it's a slow burn. And the Long Lincoln is the monster in this essentially horror story. And it's just one of the creepiest monsters in a book that I've read in a really long time. Like I haven't been that freaked out by a horror book since I first read Stephen King when I was about 12. So, that one was really good, and it really had some friendship elements. There was a pair of sisters, so there's all this family stuff. And it was interesting that the chapters alternated points of view. So it's not a really difficult book, but it does have a lot of elements of text complexity for the Common Core State Standards crowd. So I really think for a multiplicity of reasons. Oh, Common Core. For some picture books, Black Dog by Levi Pinfold. He's an Australian writer. It's an import. Just an amazing picture book. There's some brilliant wordplay. It's about a family, the Hope family, who they wake up one morning and they see that there's a huge black dog outside of their house. The father says it's as big as, oh, I can't remember the exact words they use, but every family member thinks it's bigger. And the one little boy says, it's as big as a her. It's like this thing that doesn't even exist. And the author doesn't bother to explain it. And I think that's a really brave choice to not like delineate everything. And the youngest child, her name is Small Hope, called Small for short. So it's just like this weird wordplay. And her family says, don't go out to see the black dog. It's going to eat you up. And she's like, whatever. And she goes and she leads the dog on a chase. And as they go through the landscape, the dog gets smaller and smaller and smaller until finally it can fit in through the dog door and it becomes a part of the family. And I'm not sure where it started, but a lot of times black dog will refer to depression or things like that. So this book, you can read it straight as like a kind of quirky adventure story. I would read this to kindergartners and they'd be like, look at the dog, it's getting smaller. Mm-hmm. But if you put it on more levels, you could definitely use it to talk about symbolism with older kids. And the art is just gorgeous. Like it has like kind of that, a little bit of Tenniel from Alice in Wonderland kind of feel, just, mm-hmm. and just a really beautiful book. And it was, it made the finalist list for the Sybils this year. And I was on that committee and like, that was the one I really fought for. So I'm like, it's really unique. It's really beautiful. It works on many levels. I can't recommend it enough. And on the other end of the spectrum, a really great story time book is It's a Tiger by La Rochelle and illustrated by Jeremy Tankard. It's, if any children's librarian will know, we're going on a bear hunt. And It's a Tiger is kind of an update on that motif. I could read it to pretty much any age kid and you can just really sell it because you're like, oh, you're going through the jungle and you see the monkey tails hanging down. But that tail, that doesn't look like a monkey's tail. And then you turn the page, you're like, oh, it's a tiger. And you have to run away from the tiger. And as Elizabeth Bird pointed out on Fuse number 8, it's one of the few picture books that's actually in second person, which really has no relevance to anything besides being a quirky trivia fact, but it really mm-hmm. works. And I think mm-hmm. It's a surefire story time hit. You can refresh a bunch of themes with it, animal theme, adventure theme, tiger theme. So It's a Tiger, one of my story time hits. And then a couple, just one kind of early chapter book for like kind of first through third graders, A Boy and a Bear in a Boat by Dave Shelton. It's another British import. I'm kind of showing my Anglophile bias. It's not everybody, but it is a super weird little book. It is exactly what it says. It's a boy and a bear in a boat, and they're trying to go from one place to another. You're never really sure where they are. There is a map, but it doesn't really tell you anything. There's tons of strange little meals that they eat, which I think I remember when I was a kid, I was always, it's like the never ending story element. Like when the character's eating in a book, you're like, oh, I want to have that. And you go make a sandwich and eat it at the same time. It has like these weird British sandwiches. And it is just, it is so weird. But if you find the right reader for that book, it's just going to really blow their mind. It reminded me a lot of The Mouse and His Child by mm-hmm. Russell Hobon, mm-hmm. Which is another one of those books that I wish it would. So if you find a book, a kid who likes A Boy and a Bear in a Boat, hand them A Mouse and His Child and they will just become the most philosophical, awesome kid ever. So that is that one. And a couple of nonfiction picks. I do love nonfiction and it is also a Common Core kind of thing. Marching to the Mountaintop by Anne Bossum. It talks about what events kind of led up to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in a really accessible way that I think kids will be able to follow. And I learned a lot actually, but it shows you that it wasn't just like some person just decided to shoot a person. Like it shows you like the garbage collector, you know, the unionization issues, how they were, you know, protesting their work conditions because people were dying. They were getting caught up in these garbage trucks. And that has to be an awful way to die. And how that kind of spiraled into ultimately the assassination. So it's interesting to see how events are interconnected. And it's just a beautiful book. It's beautiful to look at. It opens with different kind of quotes from you know, protest songs and other pieces of literature. So it's got a lot of different elements at play and a lot of good, a lot of times children's nonfiction will be slight on the research and citing sources. And you just get a list of, here's some websites to look at, but
yep.
I hate that. I'm like, really, where did you get this? And it did great research and it's very well laid out. So that's just a really awesome nonfiction title. And then
what's the age range for that one?
Fifth grade would probably be the youngest. I would use that with, like fifth to eighth probably. Okay. And then for fun nonfiction, The Beetle Book by Steve Jenkins. I had a really great quote with that. Line up every kind of plant and animal on earth, and one of every four will be a beetle. Steve Jenkins is amazing with the nonfiction. He does just wonderful work. He did a book called Move that you can actually use in story time. It's really full of facts, but you can also just move like the animals. And the Beetle Book is more of a kind of sit down and pour over. Like he's lovingly illustrated all of these beetles. Like the pages are chock full of facts and you can just spend a lot of time, looking through these amazing insects. It's just a really well put together book. And that kind of leads into, one of the ones I'm looking forward to in 2013. I just came across this in my reading this morning. Apparently Harcourt is going to put out a book called The Beatles Were Fab, which kind of will talk about the Beatles in relation to their sense of humor. And it's amazing how much kids are really into the Beatles. I did a book talk for some junior high kids, middle school, I guess. And, this book had some of the chapter titles were Beatles songs. I'm like, who knows who the Beatles are? And like most every kid raised their hands. And so the Beatles are still really popular. So I think it would be really interesting. And I think it'll be a really great book to see like about their sense of humor. Cause that's kind of really what like, yeah, they were attractive and yeah, their music was interesting, but I think their humor is really kind of what sealed the deal and making them as huge as they were. And then also for fiction, I saw Erica Farmer's coming out with a title called Seagulls Don't Eat Pickles, which is kind of a pirate bullying story. So I'm seeing how that one plays out. It's amazing how pirates are still kind of going strong all over the place. So I think those are kind of my major 2012 titles and a couple that I'm looking forward to in 2013.
Well, that's very cool. I wrote down several that I want to look at to use for story times myself.
Yeah, definitely.
Julie, thank you so much for giving me your list of the best kids' books for the past year, and hopefully other people will hear their list and get ideas just like I did and use them for their own library and work. So. Or to read on your own for two.
My pleasure. I hope these books get some reading done.
All right. Thanks a lot, Julie.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
I am Leah White. I am a Reader's Advisory Librarian at the Northbrook Public Library, which is a North Shore suburb of the city of Chicago. I can be found on the internet in a whole bunch of places, but you can follow me on Twitter at Leah Librarian. And you can also visit my website, which is weebly.leahwhite.com. And I'm going to have my entire list of my best of picks for science fiction and fantasy on my blog, which is on my website. So this is just a sample, but everything will be on there.
And I will link to that, too, from the show notes from this episode, too, so people can get there from there, too. So.
Okay.
And we were talking before the show that Leah is now the most frequent guest on the show, so... Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me back. I love the podcast. I like talking about books. So this is a good combination.
Yes. Well, welcome back.
Yay. Thank you. My list, I'm going to do my top five, and they're not in any particular order. I definitely have a favorite, though, and I'll tell you about that. So my first favorite from my best of science fiction and fantasy list for 2012 is The 12 by Justin Cronin. And this book is actually a sequel, so I'm going to try and kind of give you a glimpse of the world without too many spoilers. Right. It's a sequel, I know. It's a sequel to the book The Passage, which came out, I think, about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5, to a lot of fanfare. Yeah. It's being turned into a movie now, and there's all sorts of things going on for this series. But basically, the world of this series is paranormal. There's a virus outbreak that leads to humanity kind of turning into these vampire-like creatures. Not everyone does, but there's a good portion of the population that turns into these, again, vampire-like creatures. He never really calls them vampires, though, but he really almost makes fun of that concept. Like sometimes they'll call them vampires in this really like scoffing kind of laughing way, but they call them virals and they can't go out in the sunlight. They eat humans. They don't just drink blood. They crave blood, but they just kind of eat people. And they're
vampire
not
zombies.
Yeah. They actually kind of are like this weird mix of vampire and zombies. He calls them virals, and I do think he did a good job of kind of taking this concept of vampire and making it new without like making them sparkle. So the first one came out actually kind of in the middle of like Twilight Rage, where like everyone was really into this idea of romantic vampires. And then poor Justin Cronin releases this book of vampire fiction where they're legitimately really super scary. I think a lot of people found it actually really refreshing. Like those of us who were getting sick of romantic vampires, no offense to True Blood, but you know, we wanted just a monster book. And this kind of goes in that direction. So his books and The 12 also does this. They jump around in time a lot. So the first book starts during the virus outbreak and then goes, gets about 100 years into the future to look at humanity and how they kind of deal with this world where virals exist. What's cool about The 12 is that he does the same exact thing. So the last book ended at this kind of epic battle, and you begin the second book, The 12, back at the point of the virus outbreak with a whole new cast of characters. And it's almost disconcerting at first because you're like, whoa, what happened to all the people I knew from the first book? But he does a really good job of connecting a huge cast and making them relevant to the characters that you met in the previous book. So there is a purpose for him to kind of introduce this whole new group of people. And he's very skilled at kind of making this continuous thread of humanity throughout this really kind of desolate world.
And do you think is there going to be a third book?
Oh yeah, it's a trilogy. I mean, what book isn't a trilogy right now? Right. So there is going to be a third book. This book actually, it starts in at the beginning with this new cast of characters, and it also jumps back. So anyone starting The 12 and it gets a little irritated that all these characters that we became kind of in love with, they do come back. So about the second half of the book, he does jump back into what I would call the present, but it's really the future. So the point where all the like real solid action is taking place and kind of the battle to save humanity is going on. Something that I like about these books is even though he's dealing with this, again, really well-tread territory, he has a very literary style. So you can definitely tell he has his MFA. There's these very like beautiful, you know, well-crafted, almost poetic sentences.
Mm-hmm.
I actually met him at the a conference this past summer, and he talked about how Virginia Woolf was this huge influence on him, which is funny when you think about someone who's writing a post-apocalyptic like vampire novel that's set into the future. But when you actually read the book and read some of his sentences and the way that he crafts them, there's these epic battles, but there's also really small kind of inner moments with the characters that I think make it a real standout. I think it's just really unique for a type of book that's happening a lot now, which this is this kind of dystopian post-apocalyptic novel. I think it makes these books stand out in particular. And The 12 is just, it's big, but it reads fast. And it's really difficult to read before bed because you never want to go to sleep. and you just like stay up and you want to keep reading it and know what happens. So it's pretty exciting. And that's my first one on the list.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yay, Justin Cronin.
And it's nice and big and thick, too. So.
Oh, it is. They're huge. They can definitely double as a weapon on public transportation. So if someone's messing with you, just throw your copy of The 12 at them and run away. Hopefully not your library copy, though.
Yes.
I've
actually had trouble making displays of it because it like won't sit on the end cap display because it's like so thick it won't sit up there. It keeps falling off.
Because it's too big. Yeah, they are definitely big, thick books. Not to go on too much of a tangent, but I personally like to read really big epic reads in the winter. Up in Chicago, when it gets really cold, it's nice to kind of have this like big read that you can kind of consume throughout the entire season of winter. And that's what I've been doing with The 12. It's comforting. I'm enjoying hauling it around with me. I actually am carrying a bigger tote bag because I'm carrying the 12 around.
Changes your accessories.
Exactly. Okay, so my second book is much smaller. It's a collection of short stories by Kidge Johnson. And I really hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. It could also be Kig. It's K-I-J Johnson. It's called At the Mouth of the River of Bees. And she's kind of a little obscure if you're not reading heavily in the science fiction and fantasy genre or following the awards. But she has actually won a ton of awards in the past couple of years for her stories. So she's won numerous World Fantasy Awards, numerous nebulas, and she also most recently won the Hugo Award for her short stories. So she's definitely heralded in kind of like the critics' corner, but I've found that a lot of science fiction and fantasy readers haven't heard of her. So this is her first collection of collected short stories all in the same place. And it's put out by Small Beer Press, which is kind of becoming one of my favorite publishers right now. They focus on literary and fantasy lit. And one of their other authors is Kelly Link, who wrote Magic for Beginners. And I actually would recommend this book for fans of Kelly Link. So it's definitely a literary fantastical book that might even end up in the fiction section in some libraries because it's a very gray area of fantasy and literary fiction. She has really beautiful sentences, lots of big words, but they just kind of happen to take place in these kind of other worlds or kind of really absurd circumstances. A big theme throughout all of the short stories is loneliness and how just existing is kind of this state of being lonely, which is kind of interesting to me because it's such a human thing, this idea of loneliness. But then, you know, it just happens to be in a world that she created, but it just fits very well. My standout stories from the collection, I actually have two because I was obsessed with this short story collection this year. The first one is The Man Who Bridged the Mist. And It's a tale about a fictional country, kind of an empire that's divided by this really aggressive river of mist. And very few people can cross the mist except for a couple kind of natives who have grown up along this river of mist, and they ferry across the mist to get people from one side of the empire to another. And it's about a man who goes from the government to build or to attempt to build a bridge that will unite the two sides of this empire over this really kind of creepy, mysterious river of mist. And I actually was like crying and in tears by the end of it, because it's really beautiful. It's kind of a love story, but also, again, it's just, he's very, you know, isolated because he's in this village where they've always lived with the mist. And he's also very logical because he's a civil engineer. So it takes these kind of like really relatable modern concepts like civil engineering and then just plunges them into a country that would have something like an aggressive river of mist that kills people. So it kind of, I mean, she does a really amazing job. We think of science fiction and we think of like space, and we forget that there's these really, I mean, really literary, beautiful kind of stories happening that are so relatable that, I mean, anyone should read this, not just fans of science fiction and fantasy. At least in my opinion, anyone should read this. They're just really universal, beautifully written stories. The second story that I was obsessed with from this collection is called 26 Monkeys, Also the Abyss. And it's so weird and so like wonderful. It's about a woman who runs a magic show that involves 26 monkeys. So in magic show, these monkeys do all sorts of things. And then the end of the show always culminates in the monkeys climbing up this ladder into a clawfoot bathtub that's like held up into the air. And then they disappear. But what I realize is even the magician has absolutely no idea where these monkeys are going. And she kind of comes up with all these like ideas. She tries once to like follow the monkeys up the ladder and go into the tub herself and like figure out where they're going. Because the monkeys always slowly come back and they bring things with them. So they'll come back with like an ice cream cone, or they'll come back with like a comb from somewhere. It's just, they come with like stuff. So she always wants to know where they're going. And the entire story kind of about this magician woman learning about where these monkeys go. And that's, I don't know, they're not humorous at all. They're very beautiful and contemplative, I would say, would be good words. My next favorite is like the total opposite side of things. It's called Royal Street by Suzanne Johnson. And it's an urban fantasy novel. And this was my favorite. I read a lot of urban fantasy, especially in between these kind of like epic literary books that I'm reading. I need a little bit of fluff. And I don't want to say in a condescending way. I think fluff's important. Like, we eat whole wheat all week long. The weekend, you get a little bit of fluff. You get something that kind of, you know, it's just entertaining and fun. And the problem with fluff is sometimes it is difficult to find well-written fluff. And that is why I really like Royal Street. So this is the first in a series. It's the Sentinels of New Orleans series. And actually, the sequel's out already. That's another good thing about urban fantasies. They tend to kind of come out more frequently, waiting for John and Franz in book, which takes apparently 8 years to write. These take, you know, 3 months. So we can consume them faster. It takes place in New Orleans right as Hurricane Katrina is happening, which gives it a really interesting world-building aspect. So the city of New Orleans has a huge kind of hotbed of paranormal activity, and wizards are the sentinels. And sentinels are kind of like police or monitors, and they just kind of keep the two worlds separate. So it's almost like Buffy, you know, she kind of makes sure that, you know, normal people know that like all this crazy stuff exists. Sentinels are kind of like that. DJ is the main character, and she's a sentinel in training. And Hurricane Katrina happens. So after Hurricane Katrina, the divide between these two worlds goes crazy. So, and her mentor disappears. And there's this kind of like mystery aspect to it where she's trying to figure out what happened to her mentor. There's also, and I think that's what makes this book in particular pretty unique. There's a lot of description about what Katrina was like. The author, Suzanne Johnson, lives in New Orleans. You can tell she knows this place backwards and forwards. She knows what it was like to go back after the hurricane devastated their community. And that makes this urban fantasy really different and well done, and kind of takes it kind of a step up from a lot of the stuff that came out in the last year. It makes it a little serious, but it's still very... it's still fluffy, so don't worry. And there's a love story element because most urban fantasy has a love story element, but I like it. It's well done. I don't find it condescending, which sometimes it can be. Mm-hmm. And it she mixes it really well. So it doesn't feel like it's just a book about a wizard falling in love with, like, whoever. It's a story about a woman trying to find her mentor and also grappling with the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. So it feels a little more, I can't believe I'm about to say realistic, but it feels a little more realistic.
with some magic tossed in.
Yeah, there's just, you know, some wizards.
realistic wizards, though.
But that's my fluffy favorite for the past year. I'm really excited to read the sequel, River Road, and just to see how it continues. I mean, Hurricane Katrina is such a big part of the first book that I wonder how it'll kind of mix in with the books in the future. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess we'll see.
I assume that one's probably going to be a trilogy too.
Yeah, I think this is going to be like, let's see how many books we can write in this series type thing.
Continuing, you know, series.
Exactly. I think it's going to be a continuing series. That's my hunch. I don't think it's a trilogy, especially because urban fantasy readers, you know, they read a lot more. They tend to consume more in a short period of time. Trilogy, you'd get through that too fast. You know, you need 8 to 10 books to really plow through. I actually would recommend it for fans of, like, the Dresden Files or other urban fantasy novels where I think the place is really important, where the sense of place plays a big role. It's not just about wizards solving crimes.
Right, right.
Okay, my next book is Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
Yay.
And this is actually my favorite book of the year entirely, and for a lot of reasons.
Me too.
I love the other books on my list, but I found this book such a surprise, and I just can't stress how much I love it. So I keep saying it's like the best episode of Star Trek ever. It's it definitely is. I mean, I just could see this happening somehow. I want to see a film version of this so badly, but a must read for Star Trek fans. But I think it's really a must read for any science fiction show fan. I mean, if you were into Stargate, I think it could also relate to a lot of the kind of like tropes that Scalzi makes fun of, and kind of also holds almost up in respect. So it's definitely satire coming from a place of love. So the plot is, Andrew Dahl is an ensign in the Universal Union, which is very similar to Starfleet in the Star Trek world. Mm-hmm. It's basically a universal government that is almost like, I don't know, like the armed forces for going out and exploring and monitoring the universe. And he's on his first assignment on his ship, and he begins to realize that every time the crew goes away on missions to planets, ensigns, or these newbies, die, while these upper-level crew come away not just alive, but narrowly dodge death in ways that just is impossible. And there are also lots of other little quirks that he just realizes something is not right, something's not going correctly. Mm-hmm. So he starts to dig with this kind of like posse of friends, and they're really fun and well developed. And he realizes that he might be in a science fiction show. And the worst part and the best part is that it's not even a good show. So not only are they trapped in a science fiction show, it might not be a good one at all. It's hilarious and it's also very touching. I found myself just not only laughing, but I actually teared up a couple times. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me how I've never read a John Scalzi book before, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Yes,
too.
You are.
I think
yes.
I am.
Yep.
Okay. I've never read him before, and he is so good at mixing humor and humanity. It is my kind of humor. Like, it's almost like slapstick at times, but then he can bring you back to a really touching moment within pages. Mm-hmm. And I think that's difficult to do without getting hokey and cheesy. That's part of the reason it's my favorite of the year, because it has everything. It's hilarious. It has action. It's touching. I couldn't stop reading it. It's my favorite audiobook that I listened to this year. It's read by Will Wheaton of Star Trek, The Next Generation fame, but also, you know, kind of like nerd king. Mm-hmm. And
ambassador to the nerds.
Exactly. He is. He's kind of like our leader. So I love the audiobook. Now, a bit of a caveat, not everyone likes Will Wheaton audiobooks. And that's something at first I was like, what? What's wrong with you? How could you not love Will Wheaton? He does not do voices. So everyone kind of sounds like Will Wheaton, which means everyone kind of sounds like a smirking man. everyone talks like they're smirking. I personally love that. I think it just fits with this type of book. He also read the audiobook of Ready Player One, which I think fit really well. For me, Will Wheaton's one of my favorite audiobook readers.
Well, I mean, as long as he's reading the right thing. I mean, you don't want him reading Les Mis or something, but
yeah. It really is for specific types of books. Also, if you are a fan of voices, like if Jim Dale is your guy for audiobooks, Will Wheaton might not be your favorite, but I don't know. I would definitely give the audiobook a shot. I thought it was amazing.
Well, I remember when I was reading Red Shirts, I got to the, because the way, you know, it's broken up as there's the novel and then there's three codas at the end. And so I read the novel part and I got to the end. And I was like, well, that was good. That was good. It was like one of my, it was a good book. I thought it was a really good book, but those three codas at the end really turned it into mm-hmm. a great book for me.
I found the three codas. At first they felt almost like an experiment in writing. At the end of this tale, Scalzi writes additions to the books through different perspectives. It's first person, third person. I don't remember what the other one is.
First person, second person, third person, because the second one is you are this, you are doing that, you are.
Yes, yes. It's stunning. It had no idea. I'm actually, so this book has made me go, and now I'm reading more Scalzi because.
Yeah, definitely read Old Man's
Work. I had no idea.
So.
Oh, he is so talented. It took the book to another level, and that it definitely was, by the time I finished and was like bawling, I was like, this book was amazing. It did things mm-hmm. that like I haven't seen humorous science fiction do this before. And I think that's just, it's exciting. It's really exciting.
Yeah. Like you said, the whole book almost feels like a experiment that worked out really well.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I actually wonder if it could translate well to the screen. I think it could. It wouldn't be the same, obviously, because the codas wouldn't be there. But it was very impressive. Very impressive for something that I thought was going to be fluff. I thought this would be fluff. Good fluff, but, you know, mm-hmm. fluff.
Yeah, me too.
I don't think it is at all. I think it is. Just it's an excellent work of fiction.
Yeah, the codas were very, very impressive.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of Scalzi in the past, too, and I still, when I saw this one, I was like, oh, this is something that he just kind of cranked out to be silly and whatever. When you heard, mm-hmm. when you just read the description, I was like, oh, he just wants them to do a little Star Trek farce kind of thing. But, yeah, no, it was...
Yeah.
It instantly became my favorite of his books, sort of competing with Old Man's War. Old Man's War is really good, too, so you need to read that one, but...
I am writing it down right now, and I will totally, totally read it, especially if Will Wheaton does the audiobook.
I don't think he does for that one.
fail! Oh, well, that's okay.
All of his books are not as funny as that. I mean, they all have good humor in them, but this one's much funnier than his usual ones are.
Okay. All right. That's actually good to know.
A couple of his have humor in them. Android's Dream.
Yep. I know what you're talking about.
That one's a funny one, and then the Agent to the Stars is funny too.
Okay. All right. What do you do, expert?
Hey, I'm giving my best books too. Best Scalzi books.
Yeah. See, that is a list waiting to happen.
So you had one last book you wanted to talk about, too?
I do. My final book is the previously mentioned or hinted at other collection of short stories, which is by Robert Sheckley, and it's called Store of the Worlds. Store of the Worlds is a retrospective of a somewhat obscure science fiction writer. It's edited by Jonathan Leatham and Alex Abramovich, and it was actually published by the New York Review of Books Classics series, which is what really caught my eye about it. New York Review of Books publishes a lot of kind of unknown, hidden gem type authors. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they have, and I just have missed it, but I've never seen them do a science fiction book in the past, so I was intrigued and wanted to get my hands on this. Robert Sheckley was actually nominated for many awards, but he never won because he was popular around the same time, like Asimov, who really swept like every award ever. Mm-hmm. Every time he was nominated, he pretty much won. I actually kind of feel bad for Robert Sheckley because that would be kind of a rough time to be a science fiction writer, but he wrote these farces, deadpan farces, that play on the pulp science fiction genre. And it's also kind of interesting because a lot of his stories were published in these pulp science fiction magazines, but they were really satirical, which is just, I mean, they're just delightful. For anyone who's into like satire or deadpan, Bill Murray fans would probably love his short stories, if that makes sense.
He should do the audiobook.
Yes, he should. My favorite story by far in the collection is called Morning After. And it's about a man who wakes up with just this massive hangover, and he realizes that he's in the middle of a jungle, not passed out in Central Park in New York, which is where he initially thought he passed out. And he slowly kind of pieces together the night before while also being chased by aliens who want to eat him on Venus. So it's just delightful. I've never read anything like it. It's incredibly humorous and also really dark. And it just, again, this is, it challenges the notion of what a science fiction short story can be, or even just what science fiction is, because it really combines this dark style of humor that he has. And yeah, that's pretty much it. They're pretty short. They read really quickly. But I think the editors did a really good job of grabbing kind of a cross section of this author's work, and also very respectful. I had never heard of Robert Sheckley before this.
Me either.
And yeah, Morning After, find it, consume it. It is wonderful. It's hilarious and strange, and that's kind of what makes it so great.
And did that just come out this year, this collection?
Yes, it did. Okay. Yeah, it did. It's a retrospective, so all of the works are written over his entire life.
Right.
But it was published in the past year. So it counts. It counts for the best of 2012.
Yes, it slips in there.
It slips in. It's a retrospective. It's very, very well done. And also I wanted to talk about it just because I mean, I had just never heard of this dude before, and I ended up enjoying it so much that it's just one of those things you want to tell everyone you know about, because you know most people probably have not heard of this guy. So, you know, give this guy his due after years of being overlooked.
Well, it's always fun to find a new author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It really is. And yeah, that's it. That's five.
Well, very cool. Thank you for so much for sharing your picks with us. And I'm sure, I know I got some good ideas.
Oh, yay, good. And again, I actually have a lot more, and they are all going to be up on my website.
Yeah, so please, everybody go find out more about what Leah wants you to read.
Read my book.
Right. Thanks a lot, Leah.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Steve.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.